This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we would like to welcome David Sirota to the show. David is an award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and founder and editor of The Lever, a reader-supported investigative news outlet. They've got a lot of stories out about the U.S.-Israel war on Iran. We are also going to talk about their award-winning podcast, Master Plan, which exposes the 50-year plot to legalize corruption in the United States. David Sirota was nominated for an Academy Award for working with Adam McKay to create the story for the film Don't Look Up. It's about the climate crisis. That also earned him a Writers Guild of America Award for Best Original Screenplay. I will be in conversation with David Sirota at the Bioneers Conference next Thursday at 4:45 in the Golden Bear Room at the Hotel Shattuck Plaza in Berkeley. And you can get a 20% discount by using 360B20. That's 360B20. Hi, David. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, David. And huge thanks to you and your team for all of this incredible reporting. I mean, you've got a lot of pieces on Iran. Virginia Rakobin wrote the aid cuts before the Iran strikes. The Pentagon has blown through $24 billion bombing Iran so far. Here's what that money could have been spent on instead. Freddie Brewster has a piece, The Christian Zionists Fueling Trump's Iran War, for John Hagee and Christians United for Israel. War with Iran is part of God's plan and their own political mission. And then this very long piece that you wrote with Natalie Bentendorf, Ariella Markowitz, called Who Sold America? I'm sorry, this is actually also an interview on your podcast, Who Sold America on the Iran War? We trace the propaganda, the dark money, and the unanswered questions behind a war decades in the making. We could spend a whole hour on this, David. What are you all uncovering that you think deserves more attention and that many in the mainstream might not be talking about?
Well, first of all, the comparison on numbers is kind of mind-blowing. I mean, we apparently don't have money to do the most basic things in this country, but we have billions and billions and billions of dollars just sitting around ready to be used for Donald Trump's war that he seemed to wake up on a given morning and decide to launch with no congressional authorization at all. I mean, the mind-blowing stat for me in the reporting that Ronnie Riccobeni did was that the amount that we've already spent in 2.5 weeks of the Iran war would be enough to cover annually every private sector worker in America paid family and medical leave, which of course the United States is one of the only countries in the world that doesn't have paid family and medical leave. So just to really put that in relief, 2.5 weeks of the Iran war is the annual cost of paid family and medical leave for every worker in America. That's what we're doing with this money. And I think now that we see a up to $200 billion supplemental spending bill coming down the pike, I mean, the administration is trying to double down on it. And I think one thing that also comes out of our reporting is that this question of funding will ultimately, I think, decide whether or not this war goes on. I know we're going to talk about our series Master Plan, which is about presidential power. But one thing that has come through in reporting that series has been that if you look back in history, the only real way to stop a war that's out of control, that a president seems determined to prosecute without the public behind them, is Congress using its power of the purse. That's how the Vietnam War stopped. That's ultimately what started to slow down the Iraq War. That is what started to halt the Ronald Reagan's military deployments in Lebanon. And so we're moving towards a situation where I think the Democrats are trying to say rhetorically that they're against the war, but some of them are starting to equivocate on whether that means they would vote to defund the war or vote against the $200 billion supplemental bill. And I think we have to really understand that if you're voting to fund the war, you are voting for the continuation of the war. And that really what history tells us is the only thing that can stop this war in terms of a congressional action is not a resolution saying the war is not okay, but actually to defund that war.
Let's also talk about Freddie Brewster's piece, The Christian Zionists Fueling Trump's Iran War. The AP is reporting today that Pete Hegseth hosts monthly Christian worship services for employees. His department's promotional videos have displayed Bible verses alongside military footage. He argues the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation and troops should embrace God. We talked about how U.S. troops are very concerned because they were told the war on Iran was, quote, all part of God's divine plan. So if you read Freddie Brewster's piece, he writes, the morning after the U.S. and Israel began bombing Iran, Pastor John Hagee of Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas, began his globally broadcast Sunday sermon with a special note about the brilliant execution of Operation Epic Fury. He is the founder of the 10 million member group Christians United for Israel. He's a leading voice in the Christian Zionist movement. I did not realize Christians United for Israel is a 10 million member group.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a powerful force in American politics for a very long time. This idea that that there needs to be a not only Israel but a greater Judean Israel in a larger territorial expanse in order for there to be the return of the Messiah, and this has fueled a kind of religious, almost apocalyptic fervor for Middle Eastern policy. When it comes to the United States and the pressures on changing and maintaining that policy. So I think we have to really understand there are a lot of cross currents here when it comes to the Iran war. There are a lot of cross currents in the political establishment's support for the current Israeli regime and its policy, and that those are powerful forces, particularly on the American right. And I think that right now, they are getting their way in terms of the war that they have wanted. I mean, let's remember, the desire for a military conflict with Iran really has been a pretty obvious goal of the Netanyahu regime in Israel for a very, very long time. And I think that what Netanyahu has dealt with in the past are presidents who haven't been been willing to be misled into doing what the Netanyahu regime wants, and that Netanyahu found a willing participant in Donald Trump. I should also mention one other thing that hasn't been really talked very much about, which I think we should talk about, which is, you know, Donald Trump, in his family, Jared Kushner, has designs on doing all sorts of business in Israel and in Gaza. And so, you know, Netanyahu and his government will have some say, if not all of the say, over where those contracts go. And so I do think we have to talk about the fact that, in a sense, the Netanyahu regime has some leverage over the Trump family or Trump himself, in the sense of, hey, if you and your family want these rebuilding contracts, there's a little bit of a you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back potential dynamic going on here where, hey, you do my war, I'll give you the rebuilding contracts. Now, I'm not saying there's any reporting yet that there's an explicit quid pro quo there, but I think we have to understand that the relationship is not just a relationship between the United States as a country and Israel as a country and Iran as a country, that we have to go a little bit more granular here, that there is a Trump organization, a set of businesses, and the business oversight of the current Netanyahu regime, and how those things play together to shape foreign policy and military decisions, I think is very, very important for us to keep in mind.
And is that what you all discussed during this podcast, Who Sold America on the Iran War? In that episode, you all talk about the propaganda, the dark money, the unanswered questions behind a war decades in the making.
Yeah, I mean, what we do in that story is trace how dark money has funded a lot of the groups, the think tanks, the advocacy groups that have created the drumbeat for conflict with Iran, whether it's U.S.-Israel conflict with Iran or just U.S. conflict directly with Iran, how there's been a lot of anonymous dark money that has flowed into the groups pushing this. And I think the questions that we're trying to unpack in our reporting at The Lever is, what exactly do those dark money interests want? What kind of corporate interests are there? What kind of ideological interests? It's very, very, very opaque, which of course spotlights something we reported in our audio series Master Plan in season one, the effort to legalize corruption in America. I think what we have to understand is that corruption has been legalized through a 50-year secret plot, through court rulings to deregulate the campaign finance system and allow much of the political financing system to go dark, to be anonymous, to the point where it's very, very difficult to know who exactly is funding what in exchange for what. I think what our story gets at is there is a ton of money behind the push for a conflict with Iran. And it's not necessarily only money from obvious places like the fossil fuel industry and the like. It's ideological money. It's oligarch money.
David Sirota is an award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and founder and editor of The Lever, a nonprofit, reader-supported, investigative news outlet. They do incredible work. You can find them at Lever News, LeverNews.com. We're talking about David's work and the award-winning podcast Master Plan, which exposes the 50-year plot to legalize corruption in the United States. If you're in the Bay Area, I'll be interviewing David at the Bioneers Conference next Thursday in Berkeley. We'll be in the Golden Bear Room at the Hotel Shattuck Plaza. You can get a 20% discount for the Bioneers Conference with the code 360B20. That's 360B20. What are your thoughts, David, about legacy media coverage of all of this dark money, given that there's just so much of it? And I'll be honest, in our 2024 presidential coverage, we hardly talked about it because it's just so obscene to the point where, I mean, we talk about the biggest players, of course, but how do you think legacy media cover this now? And what will it take to pull this back?
Well, I think I have many thoughts on this. I mean, first and foremost, I think a lot of the coverage of politics is so much horse race coverage where money is kind of the B story. It's treated, if at all, if it's mentioned at all, it's treated as sort of background noise. It's not treated as the A story. And I think that's what we do differently at The Lever, frankly, is that we treat money as the A story. We have a simple idea. If money at huge levels is going into a system by a handful of people, it's usually buying something. It's not altruistic. It's an investment looking for a return. And I think that perspective is very, very absent from a lot of traditional media coverage of politics. Now, I will say, we were just talking about dark money, the undisclosed money that we know is going into politics to turn elections into auctions. Seems to me that forcing the disclosure of dark money should not only be a bipartisan, really apolitical cause in Congress, in the White House, in our political systems, but it actually should be a cause that legacy media outlets, independent or corporate, that the entire media industry should be in support of, because it becomes harder to do our jobs as journalists if there are not basic laws requiring the disclosure of money flooding into politics. I guess what I'm getting at is that we're trying to report. Oftentimes you'll see reporting on the money that's disclosed, the money that the smaller and smaller share of money that is disclosed, campaign contributions directly to politicians. But that is a dwindling share of the money that actually is going in to buy elections. And so the larger and larger share is this anonymous money. And so you see some reporting around disclosed money, but you see less and less money reporting around undisclosed money, because by law, we can't know where that money is coming from, so it's harder to report on them. And so we're in this dystopian situation where there's less and less money in politics reporting generally. There's less and less, what money in politics reporting does exist is on a smaller and smaller amount of the money that's actually buying elections. That's all to say that I think legacy media outlets, independent media outlets, should not just treat this as yet another political story. We all, as journalists, have a vested interest in seeing the passage of laws that strengthen disclosure so that we can do our jobs.
What are your thoughts about the Democratic pushback, if any, on this? I mean, Bernie Sanders talks about this constantly, but where are other Democrats on this issue?
So I think the Democratic Party, the last Congress, most Democratic senators signed on to some various disclosure bills. And I think that's good. I think as a sort of official position of the Democratic Party, the position of the party has largely been for more disclosure, for campaign contribution limits and the like. But there's a vast gap between saying you're for something and using power to actually deliver on something. I will give you a shining example of this. Both the Obama administration and the Biden administration could have used their power, their appointed power at the Securities and Exchange Commission, to require publicly traded corporations to disclose all of their spending on dark money political causes. That's not really a radical idea. We do that already with publicly traded corporations. If you're a publicly traded corporation, you have access to the vast resources of the public market. We say you have to do certain things. There are various fiduciary laws you have to follow, various regulatory rules you have to deal with. One of those rules could be, for investors, you have to disclose all the money you are spending on politics. And the Democratic administrations did not use their power to do that. And I think that shows the gap between what the party says it's for and what it actually does.
You know, David, a question that I've been really wanting to ask Bernie Sanders, and you've been all over this. The original Build Back Better bill was a really great piece of legislation that would have improved the lives of everyone in this country, especially the Medicare expansions that would have covered vision, hearing, and dental. And I remember top Democrats at that time said that most top Democrats supported this, of course, except for the Joe Manchins. Do you believe that, or do you think they were just saying that because they knew that it was going to get diluted?
I think there's a rotating, what I call and what others have called, the rotating villain dynamic here, where what you see typically with Democrats, especially when the Democrats have a small margin of majority in Congress, most of them will say they support a given campaign promise, knowing that one or two of them will essentially be the rotating villain. And we know the rotating villains of the past. I mean, Joe Lieberman, Zell Miller, Kristen Sinema more recently, Joe Manchin more recently. There's always seems to be a set of rotating villains. And my view is, having worked on Capitol Hill, also having worked as a journalist, is that typically these rotating villains are not acting on their own. That they are taking one, quote unquote, taking one for the team, knowing that actually there's probably 10 or 12 Democrats in a place like the U.S. Senate who want them to do what they're doing, but don't feel necessarily good about going back to their own states and saying they're happy to be doing what they're doing. So I think there's a game going on here. And I think that Democratic voters need to be more savvy and more aware of this game and less tolerant of it.
What do you think people who are so frustrated by all of this can do?
That's a great question. I mean, look, I think we're at a huge moment as dark as the situation is in America and across the world, I think we're in a huge moment of opportunity. Mm-hmm. Many years ago, I wrote a book in 2007 on the eve of what felt like a moment like this. It was called The Uprising. And the theory of the book was, we're at the end of the Bush administration, there's a huge amount of simmering anger in the country, and it's going to go in one direction or the other. It's going to go in the right-wing direction, or it's going to go in a center-left direction. And what ended up happening was it went in, much more of it was harnessed in a right-wing direction through the Tea Party and the like, and the center-left energy and angst sort of went into the Democratic Party itself through the candidacy of Barack Obama. And I think the reason that happened, and I think that was truly lamentable, because I think it was a chance to change the Democratic Party rather than just channeling energy into the current Democratic Party. I think the issue there was, is that if you looked at polls at the time, people still had faith in the Democratic Party leadership in that time. And that weakened the possibility that that angst at that moment would be channeled into changing the fundamentals of the party. And when Barack Obama turned hope and change, frankly, into more of the same, more bank bailouts, taking care of Wall Street while people were being thrown out of their homes, et cetera, that only fueled the Tea Party's argument for a backlash. All of that to say is, fast forward now, and I think this moment, we're at a similar moment of angst. But the polls that show us that people do not have faith in the Democratic Party leadership gives us a chance to actually change, finally, fundamentally change the party so that that anger and that angst can go into making a much stronger and much more serious opposition party.
David Sirota is an award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and founder and editor of The Lever, a reader-supported investigative news outlet. He's creator and host of the award-winning podcast Master Plan, which exposes the 50-year plot to legalize corruption in the United States. I'll be in conversation with David Sirota at the Bioneers Conference in Berkeley next Thursday at 4:45. We'll be in the Golden Bear Room at the Hotel Shattuck Plaza. You can get a discount for the 3-day conference, a 20% discount, with the code 360B20. 360B20. David, huge thanks to you and your team for your important work. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Nina Kissinger for producing today's show, and Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your Calls Media Roundtable.